museum specifically. One of the things I know other people have asked you about this, but it traveled so far out into the world right before you were landlocked in Texas. did traveling just before a lockdown inspire the stories?
Yeah, I think it was that just about any time I travel and I'm no longer, I teach at the University of Texas, which I really love. I love teaching. But when I'm teaching, my head is filled with other people's sentences and plot lines. And then at a break, I travel and suddenly my brain is operating in a different way. And I'm thinking, I could write a story about this, I could write a story about that. And I ended up doing it much more consciously, that there are a bunch of stories in that collection where the events happened to me, but none of the emotions and none of the characters, that I just sort of used them as a, as the taxidermy armature that's inside the animal to give it shape that looks nothing like the
right,
animal.
It's not autobiographical, but.
No, yeah, not
somebody
at all.
Really did say cut the cheese.
It was me.
I've read that story 3 times. I cannot get through that sentence.
That story, of all the stories, and again,
I hope they make a movie, Elizabeth.
None of the characters are actual people I know.
Yeah.
But that story has the highest level of anecdotes that actually happened.
Like McCracken reality.
Yes. Absolutely. And I was at a wedding in Ireland, and they said the bride and groom will now cut the cheese, and I burst out laughing, and that was how I discovered that that's only an American expression, and I was the only American there. But I stopped laughing very quickly.
Okay. Well, yeah, I think you were invited to stop laughing, it sounds like, by the quiet room, yeah?
Yes. I was like, what? I thought it was a good joke.
I love it. So can we talk about everybody's favorite couple, Jack and Sadie?
Yes.
Okay. So we meet them in one story, and then we get these subsequent linked stories. And you've said several times in interviews that those subsequent stories came pretty quickly to you. Yeah? So my question was, did you know you wanted to take Jack and Sadie across all these stories? Or did the idea or the scenario of the story come to you, and then you decided to make them the characters that deal with it? Did you decide to do the link stories, or?
Well, so what happened was, and this really makes me sound incredibly unprofessional.
Oh, yay.
Is that my wonderful editor, Helen Atzma, I was working on something else. I was working on a novel coming out in October, and I was working on that. And she said, oh, by the way, are you gonna get the story collection in by the deadline? And I went, the what now?
What deadline?
And I wrote one story after I got that email, which is not connected. And then I got run over by the semester. And then I had this like unbelievably small amount of time. She extended the deadline by a month and a half, I think. And I started writing, and I realized from a point of pure practicality that it would be impossible for me to write 5 unconnected short stories in the time that I had left. Like that it wasn't possible. And I really love connected short stories. I love to read them. And I thought, all right, I'm gonna give it a try. But the other thing was that in order to do that, I had to write them as separate stories. Like in my mind, I did not sketch out where they were going, because I think that if I had done that, they would have read as a novella, or they would have, the thing about connected short stories is if you're not careful, you can end up with not the best parts of a short story and the best parts of a novel, but the worst sides of both of them. And so I drafted each story in about a day. And then I tinkered with them. Tinkered is the wrong word. Like I worked on them. Because they did change, but I worked on them together. And I've never done that before. I've never written drafts of short stories so quickly or over such a short period of time.
Mm.
And it was fun. I mean, to some extent, because, you know, like a hanging concentrates the mind. I was like, I got to do this. But also because it felt sort of improvisational in a way that writing doesn't often feel to me. That I just told myself as I was drafting them, I just have to get it on the page. When I get it on the page, then I'll know what it is, and then I can go back and fix it. And they did shift a lot, and some of them were harder to get right than others of them were.
But it brings a sort of a craft question up for me. One of the things that Yi Yun Lee was saying is that when you read them in total, they end up telling a novel's worth of progression of a couple through life. And what is it you think that, you just mentioned it briefly, but you were saying the best parts of a short story to keep in, like that level of compression, but we still see this couple move across time, right? From the meeting until, is it the last one? My darling is the one where they're getting married, right? So this right. progression, pardon me, what do you see as, what makes that successful? It doesn't have to be in reference to these four in particular, but when people do it right, I was wondering, because it's so beautifully done in your book.
Yeah, that's one of those things. It's much easier for me to talk about somebody else's work. I think part of it is that it feels like there's something kind of thrilling about being a reader and jumping over years and characters. When a writer just says, all right, you know that, now it's 30 years later. And I love that as a reader. I love it in novels as well and within short stories. And when connected stories work well, there's sort of a pleasure in going, now forget what you know from that last story, because this is a completely different angle. Yeah. And you don't have to worry how they got here, but this person will be familiar to you in an interesting way.
Yeah.
I like them because they can be a little bit like life when you see somebody after 30 years and you think both about how alike they are to their young self, their teenage self, or their 20-year-old self, mm-hmm. and also how utterly changed. And that can be moving and heartbreaking in real life. And I think when it works in connected stories or in fiction that does that in general, there is that sense of seeing how somebody has panned out, how their life has worked upon them and how they have moved through life. Yeah.
It's a beautiful way to talk about how what get sort of memory and nostalgia, when it's done correctly, can jump into now we're in this present moment. And I guess maybe what part of what I hear is you successfully bring the person forward in a believable way.
Yeah.
That we can sign up for.
Yeah, and it's not about retrospection in that case. It's about time passing.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not about looking back, and I like that.
Yeah, it's a beautiful way to say it. Yeah. Well, gonna jump a little bit. I wrote to you about this on Twitter. You had said, in a fit of pique, I wrote a 10,000 word story. Now, I know it's in progress and we need to stay outside of the locked door of your writing studio. But since I feel like we can maybe peek in the window if you'll let us, can you talk to me about the process of that, of something creating some reaction in you and that turning into a story? Is that something you can talk about?
Sure. And I can't even remember. It was a fit of pique. Now I can't remember what I was mad about. But there was something that irritated me that's not about the story itself, but that I just thought, as I often do, particularly if I'm irritated about something in the in my writing life, or sometimes my university life too, actually, if I'm think that's not right, that I try to take that energy and go to write if I can, because otherwise it's the sort of irritation where all you do is walk around muttering to yourself in your head and doesn't achieve anything. I feel it's a great motivation, pointless emotion, to try to channel it into actually writing as opposed to having arguments with strangers or people who I know well. And so, yeah, I was ticked off and I wrote a really long short story, which I haven't quite gotten right yet. There's one section of it that I'm still trying to fiddle with.
It was more about the being bothered. It wasn't the topic. It was just the aggravation led you to productivity.
Yes. That's because I'm a New Englander.
We're outside the locked door of your writing studio.
New Englanders are often irritated, but we also feel we should be working harder.
Reminds me of this thing Louise Erdős said once, where they said, you know, how did your background make you a good writer? What about your history made you a good writer? And she said, severe repression.
Yeah.
All right. So can you tell us anything about your upcoming novel? What would you like to tell?
Sure. It's a very little novel. It's probably, I'm laughing because we were talking about accurate fiction. It's probably more accurate than most of the stuff that I write. Hmm. And it is about a woman who's in London, who's remembering her mother who has recently died. And in fact, when I started writing it, I was in London thinking about my mother who had recently died. And I'm pausing because I'm trying to figure out the right word to describe it. I don't actually know what autofiction is. And it's not that it's autobiographical. I guess it is autobiographical, but a lot of it is about what makes something fiction and what makes something a memoir. That's sort of one of the topics of it as a novel, which I'm
insisting. Big open topic right now, isn't it?
Novel, yeah. And I wrote it mostly in 2019, the first draft of it.
This and is it a was, different book than the one your publisher was mean about?
Oh yeah, that's book, that.
That's far, that far in the past.
It's far, far in the past. And a different publisher. Yeah.
Can you give us a hint about historical era? Is it present day?
2019.
Oh, it's set in 2019.
Yeah.
Ah.
And there are scenes that before
You've done
that.
It.
Yes, it is, Mike. It is a contemporary-ish novel. And then, of course, I wrote in 2019. I'm like, this is really up to date. And then something happened to render it into history, into the old era. Like, absolutely.
That's wild.
It was actually quite strange and interesting to have history sealed off a few months after the events of the novel. So everything that happens in it could not be happening now. Because, you know, there's somebody walking around and going to the theater and going to museums and thinking about the past. And yeah, and it's strange to understand that and it's a little like the short stories in that I, you know, many of the events, not all of the events in the 2019 part of the novel actually happened to me. But I didn't realize, a lot of them did. And I didn't realize as I was doing them that it would be the last time that I would walk around a foreign city by myself in that way, sort of idly thinking and not fearing strangers and not
worrying about elevators.
Yeah, in my own body by myself, as opposed into the public body as we all live at the moment.
Isn't that wild that it marked a history that is past? Yeah. Like that you're now writing something that's definitely, I mean, you're done with it, but writing something that is that distinctly on the before side.
Yeah, I think so. I don't know if you do. I think so much about like how much this, I think about other things. I think about the sadness of people who have died and you know, all that. But I also think about fiction and like what it means for contemporary fiction. Is nothing can be set in 2020 or 2021 or so far in 2022.
Yeah.
That's not about the pandemic.
Right. Or it appears to be ignoring the main event in world history. So right. I often wonder about that. Like, are you not allowed to, or you have to date yourself if you're going to write something contemporary? I don't know.
Because it's this quotidian disaster. It's every single day it has an effect on how people live, as opposed to, you know, I think if you specifically set a book in November of 2001, it would be weird not to mention the September 11th attacks.
Yeah.
In America, if it was set in America. But you wouldn't immediately go, well, wait, why aren't they doing this? But, you know, even now I sometimes read fiction that was written just in the 21st century and I think, but where are their masks? Or do you watch movies sometimes and go, oh my God, they're breathing all over each other?
It's the cell phone. There's no cell phone. Well, because the situation would be solved because she'd call someone.
Yeah.
Right. I often talk about that just as an older person that, like, yeah, we used to just go to Europe and pick a place in Amsterdam to meet, and no one could you couldn't talk to anyone. You just showed up.
Yep.
And somehow we all worked it out without a cell phone. And, you know, my kids are like, what? How did the world work?
Yeah.
Yeah, and there's no way to say, even if you didn't want to focus it, we don't know what the post looks like. I don't even know the right word for it. Post is the wrong word, right? You can't, yeah. There is no post. There's only altered world that will be that we don't know what that will be. What will Europe look like? What will it be? Like when I was reading Souvenir Museum, I was like, well, what if Elizabeth went back to any of the places set in that book right now? I don't even know what that would be. I mean, just like Legoland in Scandinavia.
I'm sure Legoland in Denmark is still ticking along. So that's a story that was written in a fit of pique because we spent a lot of money to go to Legoland. We went with friends and their kid, my husband, Edward Carey, our kids, and we all just hated it so much.
I think there should be a beautiful word for the parental feeling of sacrificing yourself by going to the altar of unending consumerism because your child wants it, and just the depth of compressed hatred as you step through it, and it's a horror.
It would have been worse if the children had loved it. It was actually a great relief. Oh no, they hated it.
Oh, so you got to have like a familial regret.
Yeah.
Why do you think they hated it when they wanted to go? Weren't they the reason you went?
I think they were. Yes, I'd like to make that very clear. I didn't.
It wasn't my idea.
I've been longing to get a Legoland. Although I think I was interested in it. I think this is actually in the story. I think they loved Lego. And therefore the word Legoland just sounded like it could be anything. You know, like this world that gave them the feeling that Lego gave to them.
Like being surrounded by this thing that's usually in front of you.
Yeah, yeah.
But what happened?
And I think we got there and it was really loud and you had to wait for everything. And then later, this was originally gonna be in the story, we went to the Tivoli Gardens in Copenhagen, which is like a dream amusement park. It is so beautiful and wonderful. And what you would imagine, I think, when you think Danish amusement park, is sort of humane and woodsy and, yeah, woodsy is the right word.
And the kids liked that better?
They did.
Everybody liked it better, sounds
like. Everybody liked it better.
Yeah.
It was just better.
Well, I'm excited for the new book. When is it coming out again?
October 4th, I think.
I wonder if you'll be able to do a book tour.
It's always an interesting question.
How are publishers talking about it right now? Are they even talking about it?
Yeah, I mean, I think sort of everybody understands that it would be foolish to make any plans for October one way or the other, because you just don't, you know. Mm-hmm. As you know, we keep going, well, maybe it's almost over, then nope. So, I mean, I hope so, partly because I really got into writing for free plane travel and hotel rooms, which are two of my favorite things. And also because I like giving readings to people. I just recently gave
them I have to say it's one of the things I miss the most. Is yeah, to be in the room to hear the person who wrote it read their own words, and to be in the room is, I mean, that's, you know, a lot of what we do in Portland.
I miss it so much. I miss sitting in an audience full of people and having that. I miss being in an audience in general, but at readings, you know, having both the individual and the community experience at the same time. And I miss giving readings. I just gave a reading, which was lovely for Brigham Young University, but it was online. And I understood, my internet went out, and then I used a cell phone as a hotspot. And I gave this reading, and halfway through the reading, I suddenly thought, it is possible that my internet is out, and there would be no way for me to tell.
I am talking to myself.
I am just sitting in my bedroom, which is where I was delivering this literary reading, just talking to myself.
Impressed with my own words.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, I miss it. I hope to go out. And I hope to sit in an
audience
store or a auditorium on campus at UT and listen, because I do really miss that. There are thoughts you can only have when you hear somebody else read their work to you.
Absolutely. I agree completely. So speaking of, one of the things I like to ask everybody when I interview them is I really like to think about who are some writers that you would like to shine a brighter light on that you are feeling moved by or inspired by? No pressure. But like, who would you have me interview? Who would you?
God, I'm one of those people with me like, what are you talking about? I've never read a book in my life.
No, I know it puts you on the spot, Elizabeth. I'm sorry. But
so I'm madly looking at my bookshelves and thinking, well, it's true. You mentioned Yun Lee, and she's one of my favorite writers.
Oh, I love that she was your student. That was so sweet to watch the two of you. When was she your student? Was she like an undergrad or?
No, she was a graduate student at Iowa. And she's a genius. Mm-hmm. She may be one of the only people who went first through the MFA in nonfiction and then through the MFA in fiction.
Oh, I didn't know that.
And she'd come to Iowa to be a graduate student in science.
She just fell in.
Yeah.
It worked out pretty well.
Yeah. And she'd always been a very serious reader and always, I think, wanted to be a writer. Mm. But yeah, no, she's extraordinary. And I'm interviewing, I'm doing a bunch of book events for people in the next.
What were you, hosting them when they're reading their
work? Yes, yeah, I'm doing, because the model has gone largely to Q&A formats.
Yeah.
So I always do like it when the author reads a little bit. Mm-hmm. And I don't know why I'm doing so many, but they're all amazing books. Like, I think there were months when I didn't do any last, I wasn't asked to do any. Mm-hmm. And then I got asked to do a Q&A with Antoine Wilson, this book called Mouth to Mouth, which is fantastic. Mm-hmm. He was also a student of mine. And tomorrow night I'm talking to Lan Samantha Chang, who's the director of the Iowa Writers Workshop,
yeah,
who's
got
an amazing new novel out. Next week, Nina de Grammont for The Christie Affair, which is amazing and is a Reese Witherspoon book club book. And then Sarah Manguso, who is one of my favorite living writers, who's mostly written nonfiction. At some point during the pandemic, I reread all of her books, and her first novel's coming out. And then my colleague, Deb Olin Unferth. Do you know Deb's work?
I haven't heard of that, no.
I think you would love it. And she's this book that's it's been chosen for sort of an all-Texas book club. And she's got a book called Barn 8, which is about
think I've heard that title, Barn 8.
It's a very strange and wonderful book. And it's like a heist book. It's about people who are animal rights activists who decide to kidnap a million hens from battery farms in the Midwest.
I've definitely heard about that book. Oh, good. Well, those are some great recommendations. But I think this might be a good place to stop. That sound okay?
Yes.
Thank you so much for spending time with us.
Thank you so much, Robin.
Oh, yeah. It was lovely to be with you. I'm just going to turn this. Thank you.
You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kbu.fm.
Bienvenidos a un breve informativo en su estación comunitaria KBOO 90.7 FM. Hoy jueves,